Chariot Developer News, episode number 24, up to 24. That's pretty far.
That's good.
Yeah. For Monday, September 20th, 2010, I'm Ken Rimple.
I'm Eric Snyder.
And we're here to talk about the tech news of the day. So, Eric,
yes.
We got a lot of stuff. I've taken a couple weeks away. After the other couple weeks away in August, I've now had a couple weeks away in September due to just getting super, super busy. But hopefully we're going to start on a more normal track again. So my apologies to everybody about being, you know, slow at getting the news out. We have a number of things to talk about this week, but just a quick amount of housekeeping. Coming up, we're actually going to send a fair number of people to the Mobile Monday event, which is being held in downtown Philadelphia tonight. And so we'll have some analysis from that in a future episode of the podcast coming up soon. Another thing I want to mention up front from Chariot is actually we have an event, very low-cost event, $99, coming up on October 12th. And it's a continuous integration forum, basically. We're going to have a full day. Looks like we have five sessions here. And we have Atlassian and Sonatype are both coming. And we also have Trotter Cashin, who now works for Mashion. And he works with Chef and all sorts of Ruby-based integration tools. So we're going to have talks from each of those gentlemen. We're also going to have a talk from Aaron Mulder of Chariot. Talking about how to check metrics on builds and, you know, get a feel for what kind of healthier application is delivering. And then I'm going to run a wrap-up panel discussion just to kind of take audience questions and see what people are thinking about in their own enterprises. To learn about it, you go to chariotsolutions.com/events/CI, and that'll take you to the registration page. There's also an announcement on our homepage at chariotsolutions.com.
Cool.
All right. Yeah, so that should be a fun one. We actually... we're holding it out in the Conshohocken and Marriott, and again, it's low cost. We'll have lunch and 9 to 3. All right, so let's get started with the first things. First on our list is that from the Grail side of things, GORM, which is the object relational mapping tool based on Hibernate from GORM, is now supporting Redis. Now, Redis is a in-memory key value store. Does that sound right?
Yeah, it's a high-performance in-memory key value store.
Okay, what he said. And I know that right now SpringSource is, or VMware really, is funding development of Redis.
Right.
So that's why the tie-in and why they're so tight. If you go to the Redis site at code.google.com/p/Redis, you'll see actually all the new work on Redis is sponsored by VMware.
This is interesting because this is really the first step into the NoSQL side for SpringSource. So, for Grails anyway, I'm just wondering if GORM is going to embrace any more NoSQL backends.
Yeah, good question.
What the plans are. I mean, I haven't really checked into it too much, but so I don't know if there's sort of a generic layer that they're coming up with that they can plug this into.
Well, I guess GORM would really be it, right? So, I mean, if you're looking at least from the Groovy side, it would be GORM and then whatever platform it's supporting.
Okay.
I guess.
I know from the Django side.
That's my theory.
Their plans to incorporate some NoSQL backends requires some fairly significant refactoring.
I have an answer for you.
Okay.
It actually says in the page, if you go to the SpringSource blog, this was on 9/7/2010, and I believe it was by Graham Rocher, who's the founder and creator of Grails.
Okay.
He has a line right in there as you're speaking of it. The Redis plugin itself is built on the inconsequential code base, which is designed as an abstraction above NoSQL stores. So there you go. Even better, right?
Inconsequential?
It's called Inconsequential, which it lives
sounds
on
pretty, GitHub. Pretty GitHub. Consequential to me.
It lives on GitHub. It's github.com/grails.
Oh, that's very cool.
Yeah.
Okay, so you could probably use that for other things as well.
That's what I'm thinking anyway.
Yeah.
That's very cool. So anyway, GORM for Redis, and they have a nice little simple example. Here's these. Of course, you know, Eric and I didn't want to get to see this, but you install a plugin called Redis, and then in your class, in your entity model class, you say static map with equals Redis, which means this is a Redis object, and then it just uses that for GORM.
Cool.
Which is really neat, and they show you how to query it.
So the public-facing API, it looks very similar. It's the same, basically. Yeah.
Yeah, and it looks like you can do things like find all by last name, all the cool things that make GORM a nice API for us Groovy developers.
Okay.
Okay, great. Let's see. Let's talk about Rails 3 and REST. You found this article, Eric.
Excellent RESTful support has been baked into Rails for ever since Rails 2.
But, sure, yeah.
This guy, Jeff Dean, he has a blog, is actually a pivot. He works for Pivotal, so it's a Pivotal Labs blog.
Mm-hmm.
He blogged about building a fast, lightweight REST service with Rails 3. So the whole idea is, you know, a lot of times you're building these RESTful APIs, you're not, it's usually, you know, maybe a piece of your application. There's usually a UI component still to your application. But he wanted to build a pure RESTful API. He didn't have any, you know, user-facing aspect to his application, at least not a public one.
Right. So kind of like Netflix or something like that, where you're kind of publishing a REST API on an engine.
Exactly. So there's a lot of, you know, extra things in Cruft that you don't want.
Right.
So he wanted to make it as lightweight as possible.
Cool.
So the whole point of this isn't necessarily how to make a – I mean, it is nice to learn how to make a RESTful API, but it's really more about how can I strip out the things that I don't need
from this.
So, you know, low footprint –
Right.
You know, so it goes into what you have to change to strip out all the extra cruft. So I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, the routes file is nice and small.
It is. It's very small. you know, he takes away all sorts of things. Like basically, he comes up with his own application controller because everything is based on rack metal now. So, you know, he bases his application controller off of metal. Basically, it's you know, closer to the metal, what he's doing, that he doesn't need the, you know, everything that comes with the regular Rails application controller.
Right.
So this shows you how to do that. So it's some good stuff.
Cool. Very cool. All right. On to a completely different language. We're language hopping today, right? We started with a Groovy and then we went
polyglot, man.
I mean, we got a polyglot podcast. So let's talk Google Go. I still have yet to understand where this is going to play in reality.
Yeah, I haven't really touched it.
Yeah, but you know, if you want to play with it, you now don't really even have to download Go to play with it. They just revamped their homepage. You know, you got to wonder, actually, a little side note, like I wonder if Go is like hedging their bets on the Java VM being alive in 5 years. Like maybe they're saying, let's create our own language so that if everything goes belly under, we can replace Java with Go and Android.
So the thing I don't understand, I mean, I'm sure Go is pretty cool, and I'm sure it has its own niche to fill.
Mm-hmm.
But
what
internally, they had Python, right?
Right.
Now they're also officially internally supporting Go within Google, amongst other things.
Right.
My question is, why?
Right.
So
there must be a reason.
There must be a reason.
Yeah. There could have been a reason for Wave, too, but we all know that that was also kind of one of those, what do you call them, fifth-day project, one of the 20%
time? Yeah, so that's the assumption we always make. There must be a reason. Well, maybe there isn't. Maybe, you know.
They try lots of things.
Maybe somebody had an itch that they wanted to scratch and so they wrote their own language. I have no idea.
Well, you know, they are famous for like putting together things and putting them out there and seeing whether they live or die. So, you know, hey, you got to look at that and say, well, some of the stuff lives. That's a great bet to take.
Know? I wish I had the time to check it out.
I know, me too. Same thing. Well, if you do have the time to check it out, you don't even have to install the compiler now, which I actually did and then never did anything with.
Right.
But if you go to the golang.org, they actually have a little page right there on the front that says, you know, you can install Go now, or you can try it right here in your browser, and they have a little box, and you can type in a program, and you hit compile and run. So you can hack around with the syntax.
That's cool.
And in fact, if you hit the drop down, they've got a little Fibonacci closure in here, so you can kick that off. What else do they have? There's really cool stuff. Concurrent prime sieve. That's really neat stuff. All very comp sci type stuff. But still, you're looking at kind of what the code would look like if you were going to build it.
Right.
Neat. All right, let's do the Python triple here. All right, we're gonna do three Python slash Python-y things. So go ahead with Pyjamas. I love Pyjamas as a name.
Yeah, well, you know, that's one of the main advantages I think Python has over any other language is that
names?
It starts with Pi.
Yeah.
So it just makes all these projects sound very cool.
And the PyCon.
Yeah. You know.
PyCon. So, yeah.
But anyway.
All right, so Pyjamas.
Pyjamas, it's not a new project. It's been around for a while, but I think it's starting to gain some momentum. And I just found a blog entry on it, so I thought I'd talk about it. It's a direct ripoff of GWT.
Oh, okay.
But Python.
So basically generating JavaScript and HTML and CSS.
From Python.
By browser, from Python.
From Python.
Okay.
Exactly.
Interesting.
So, so, you know, if you like GWT, if you like that, you know, that swing-ish component model of development, so if you have an app that's more like, I don't know, what you traditionally consider like a desktop style application, but you want it on the web.
Right.
You know, or even if you just want it on the desktop, if you like that model of development, so you take your components and you wire them together, you know, or you want to build components rather than the mishmash of which, by the way, I like the mishmash, but of you know, HTML or HTML5, JavaScript, and you know, you have to sort of be multimodal and understand different models. And you're a Python guy, then Pyjamas is the way to go. Now, that being said, So one thing about the Python and definitely the Pyjamas community is they don't take themselves all that seriously. So.
Good.
So under the front page, if you go to I don't get it, right, click on Guide to Pyjamas, they have like this internal conversation. It's like – I'm not going to read the whole thing. It's like 5 pages long. But it's basic – I mean, I'll read a little bit of it. So
yeah, grab an excerpt. This is worth it. This is funny.
So what's Pyjamas? It's a widget set. What's a widget set? It's where you can do stuff. What kind of stuff? Well – make things look pretty. Why? Because you can see them better. See what? The stuff. How do you do that? In Python.
I like snakes.
Python isn't a snake.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't.
Is.
Isn't.
Why wouldn't you use snake?
It's Python.
And so on and so on. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, didn't you say Python was kind of created around the Monty Python community, the name?
It is. So it is. Although for copyright reasons, they can't actually have the images anywhere. But so
if you don't take themselves, that's great.
The funny thing is if you go through that whole conversation by the end of it, it actually makes sense. They do explain the whole point of it all. So
that's pretty awesome. Yeah. I mean, the one thing I'm not necessarily an anti fan of GWT. You know, I'm not opposing it.
Sure.
GWT. Yeah. But the one thing I noticed was when you're building a GWT project, it actually sits there and it does all this work to generate everything. It takes a long time.
It does. Yeah.
Do you have the same thing in Pyjamas?
Well, there is a generation step, but I mean, if you look at I guess it's on the FAQ, they kind of explain, you know, if you're this enterprise developer and you're used to GWT, there's like hundreds of thousands of lines of code.
Yeah, it's big.
Everything's an order of magnitude, at least smaller.
Oh,
with
okay.
Pyjamas, including the documentation well, and the community. Well, so, you know, right. So that's something to keep in mind.
It's a trade-off.
It may not be something you want to do for your large critical right. enterprise system.
Right.
Or maybe it is. I don't know. But, you know, it's...
Well, totally unrelated to this, but it's not totally unrelated, but semi-related to this is, I don't know if you know, but as I'm working on the Rubik, one of my next chapter segments to write was all the rich internet web API. So
right.
First was, okay, I'll do a quick section on Webflow. That was nice and satisfying because it's pretty much one command, and then you just kind of talk about how Webflow works in Roo.
Right.
That was straightforward. And then I got to the GBT stuff, and I kind of vapor logged I don't want to say anything negative because I know they're really busy on this, but GBT 2.1 is a big release coming up.
Uh-huh.
They're working with the Roo team, and at the same time, they're building 2.1 and they're building in features that frameworks like Roo would use, and right. Roo is building support for GBT. And of course, I can't do anything with it because it's not ready yet. So
right.
I've been wrestling with GBT a little bit, but only in terms of the 2.1 in the middle of release.
Right.
So I really like to see it. But you're right. There's a lot of code there. If you say like GWT setup in Roo, which is the Spring for side note, the Spring tool that basically generates Spring projects for you and manages them. It does generate a ton of code
right.
and adds to your Maven build and adds all these steps, but at least it does it for you and you don't have to do it yourself.
Right, exactly.
So anyway, that's just a little side note that, you know, they're even on these cross-compiling projects. You're talking about the sophistication of GBT. I totally get that because it is sophisticated and complicated to set up by hand.
Right.
So I'll have to do a little special or something. Ben Alex and I are going to be talking, I think, in the next couple of weeks. I'm trying to line him up for an interview around what's going on in Roo, and I want to talk to him about GWT because it's kind of interesting where that's headed. All right, cool. So Pyjamas, I don't get it. That's great. All right, let's talk about Jellyfish.
Jellyfish. Okay, so this is in here just because it's something that I'm interested in.
Yay.
I doubt it's going to be useful to that many people. So please forgive me for including this in
here. No, it's okay.
In a former life, I used to specialize in, I guess you could call them customer data integration solutions. That's such a consultancy type of word.
Moving stuff in, getting stuff out.
But I actually wasn't a consultant when I did this. So basically what I used to specialize in is companies have, you know, they have all these various data stores and different silos and things like that. And so you have customers represented in different ways. So, you know, they purchase through some other channel or this channel or that channel. And there's no way to tie them together. Except through common name and address type of thing. So, you know, I used to do all these things with name and address matching. And one of the things that was important is matching to accounting for like typos and things like that, especially in address data.
Right.
Jellyfish is a Python library that I think would be useful for a lot of people to use, even if it's just a small part of their project is Python. And again, you could use this in No, I guess you couldn't use it in Jython. Never mind. It's got a C extension. Mm-hmm. But there's all sorts of really cool string comparison routines in here and phonetic encoding routines.
Oh, that's so cool. They're all like in one place.
They're all in one place. So it's not just, you know, the old Soundex, which is in here.
Right.
Which, you know,
just
works.
Just one of four of the phonetic ones.
Yeah, it works for some data sets, but not for a lot. But, I mean, Metaphone is very cool.
I guess that's all phonetic-based, right?
It's all phonetic-based. Yeah, right. And, you know, may work for some languages better than others. Mm-hmm. But NYSIIS, which is very common for census data, things like that.
Okay.
And then there's string comparison, so the distance between two strings. Some of these report, you know, values between 0.0 and 1, 1 being a perfect match.
Right.
They have different scales, but I used before like this Jarrow-Winkler distance algorithm. So it's just really cool if, for example, if you're storing name any sort of string, you know, that's like a name or a street name or something like that, you can use this to calculate these values and store them like the phonetic encoding in the database. Or if you're doing a search, you can use these string comparisons. Levenshtein distance, Jarrow-Winkler, Hamming distance. There are all these algorithms for doing phonetic string comparisons.
It's very cool. Michael Stevens, it sounds familiar. And James Turk. Okay. And that's at pypy.python.org. Oh, never mind. It's a long link. Just look up jellyfish and Python. You'll find it. We'll put the link in the show notes.
Yep.
Very cool. All right. Now let's go to a tongue-in-cheek topic of its own, right? Why Django sucks and how we can fix it?
Yeah, so that's another example of why I like the Python community so much. So
I flipped through these slides. Some of these are really funny.
Yeah. So basically, this was put together by Eric Florenzano, who is a Django, like a hardcore Django developer. If you listen to the Django Dose podcast.
Oh, he's the co-host.
He's the co-host. He's an excellent podcast. So he's clearly a Django fan.
Well, now I have one to put on my list because I don't know much about it. It'd probably be good to listen to a podcast a little bit.
Exactly.
Cool.
So basically, this is kind of tongue-in-cheek, but, you know, not totally. He is serious in part. So what sucks? And he lists a few things. So in order, he goes apps, generic foreign keys, memory usage and performance, settings, exclusionary establishment, and bad batteries. So if you don't go past that slide, you'll never use Django.
Right.
But
scared off.
If you get through it, you'll realize that, you know, he's just suggesting things to improve in the framework. So, you know, as far as apps go, Django has this concept of reusable apps, which is very cool. You can plug in things like I need a tagging engine, I need a comment engine or whatever. You just plug it into your Django project.
Almost like plugins, but they're like mini applications that get embedded.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So each one has its own complement of models and views. And
gotcha. Things.
Yeah. But there's issues with it and like, you know, you end up having to modify them ultimately, in which case then they're not reusable anymore. So he gets into that and things that that the Django community can do to fix it. So, and then there's, I'm not going to get into generic foreign keys and everything, but you know, there's just various things. One thing that he gets into that is unrelated to the source or Django itself is, he says, it's an exclusionary establishment. Mm-hmm. This is the old issue of who gets the commit bit.
Okay.
So, yeah, so, you know.
So there's a small number of.
Right now it's pretty exclusionary. I mean, okay. And it's all. So Python is moving from SVN to, you know, a DVCS. And right now Django is also SVN. So that's possibly one of the reasons for it, you know, because it's hard to give out the commit bit to a centralized, you know, repository.
Right.
But, you know, he's arguing for more community involvement, movement to a DVCS.
Stupid question. DVCS for some of us who haven't.
Oh, distributed version control.
In other words, Git or
Mercurial or something like that.
Yeah.
So he argues against there's a private mailing list just for Django core developers. You know, so those with the commit bit.
Oh, I see.
You know, so it's not as open. That's a fair statement, though.
It is a fair statement. I mean, we've gotten that same complaint on other open source projects too.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I guess there's issues with that. And then specifically, he references Alex Gaynor, who's the other co-host for Django.
He looks about three. He's young.
He is. I think he's in college right now.
Yeah.
He does.
Probably smarter than any of us in this room.
He's brilliant. This guy is really, really smart.
Wow.
So
he's the other guy on the show.
He's the other guy on the show.
Cool.
You know, and he points out, you know, it makes no sense why he's not a core developer. So I'm not plugged into the internal politics.
Sure.
I don't know if there's good reasons or not, but He's one of these guys that's been contributing to Django in a very positive way for a few years now, but he's not yet a core developer.
So he has to submit a patch for one of the core developers to put in, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Even though he could do the whole thing himself.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. Okay.
We're not bad-mouthing. Yeah. We're just more, bringing up what he's bringing up in the app. Yeah,
exactly.
In the discussion. Okay.
Right. So...
Okay. No. We'll put a link to that in the show notes again. By the way, I haven't mentioned it at all yet. It's delicious.com/developernews/24 will be the URL for that. And then you'll see the links. And we'll also put it on techcast.cherrysolutions.com in our actual show notes of the episode itself.
Okay.
All right. Cool. Moving on then. Now, this is just a side note. We talked about the lawsuit, the Google and Oracle lawsuit. Where Oracle is suing Google for taking charge of stuff from several patents of theirs and implementing their own versions of some of the software when they were building Android and the Android cross-compiling and VM and everything. The Free Software Foundation actually – this is on InfoQ. I'll read the headline from Charles Humble on September 11th. It's the Free Software Foundation offers grudging support to Google in patent case. And actually, even Oracle back in 1994 opposed the patentability of software in a letter to the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. And actually, InfoQ has a link to that letter. So basically, they're coming back and they're supporting Google being able to work on and extend and change works and that they're against the whole patenting procedure. So just a little interesting note. People are starting to weigh in different areas.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing. There's so many companies that at one time opposed software patents, and now all of a sudden –
they flipped because they're making money from
it. Of course.
Yeah. They're making money and they're afraid,
Yeah.
Yeah, it's still a very interesting thing. It seems like the lawsuit came out, was announced about a month ago, and then just – it got very silent. I don't know if you noticed this, but there's not a whole lot going on in terms of like just messaging about it. I'm getting news on different things Oracle's doing, different things Google's doing, and they're not really bringing it up. So this is going to be a long, slow burn, I think.
Oh, yeah, this is going to be years.
It's going to be the background, yeah. So just a little side note. And then they do reference Charles Nutter's article, which you mentioned last time, which is an excellent
very
summary.
Good, yeah.
Very good summary. Okay, another interesting thing that happened. Developers of the iPhone are somewhat rejoicing this month. If you're already an iPhone developer, you probably know this. But if you're not, you're thinking about it, and you were concerned because you weren't sure just like what the reasons were where they were rejecting applications and some of the restrictions they put on, they've at least now clarified some of this stuff. Not everything. But they came out with a paper that basically said you can now run applications that were generated from things that generate Objective-C code, which was basically all those little frameworks that were out that I can't remember the name of any of them right now, but that you could basically write in Python or in Ruby or some other language and generate an iPhone app. They were restricted, at least under licensing.
Right.
They wanted to keep basically anything like Flash, Flash CS5. There was a feature they almost implemented in Flash CS5 to basically take your Flash app and turn it into an iPhone app by cross-compiling it.
Right, but you still can't actually run Flash.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you still can't run Flash.
Right, right.
But what they've done now is they basically said to
you
Adobe...
you can use the Adobe tools to generate your app.
They said, Adobe, that's legitimate. You can do the cross-compiling. You just can't run Flash
itself.
Yeah,
they're definitely bowing to the pressure.
Yeah. They have to.
Yeah,
I mean, if you look at Android, it's just like rolling over and huge in number.
Right.
I don't think Apple ever really thought they would be number one forever.
Sure.
But they were number one in this kind of, app market for a long time.
Right.
I think in the end it'll be more like, Apple versus Windows. You're going to have a large number of developers on, any kind of platform doing Android.
Sure.
With its drawbacks, because Android, basically the vendors can cut it apart and do what they want with it.
Well, there's already evidence, and I know I heard this on This Week in Tech. I can't reference the exact show that, even though the Android market may end up being – well, it is larger. But, it may end up being significantly larger than the iPhone store, for example. You can still make more money in the iPhones.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So it's very typical. So, Apple owns a small piece of the market, but it's the most profitable piece of the market.
Right.
So that's all they really care about.
Yeah. It's curate. Leo Laporte was talking about this it was probably the last MacBreak Weekly.
I think you're both listening
to the same one.
Yeah.
And his point was, by the way, great podcast. His whole point was, I think curation is so important.
Yeah.
That, someone is there actually trying to take a look at this stuff and not putting another fart app out there, which is what.
Well, no, that doesn't – nothing's – they don't stop you from doing that.
They don't stop you, but they're actually right. trying to say that they could now. So in other words, they're saying that – well, I think the line that they brought up was there is a line and you'll know – we know it when we see it. As they're quoting kind of a Supreme Court justice who had said that at one point.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
So they're actually saying they reserve the right to reject applications that go across the line of decency.
Okay.
But then I think I also read somewhere that one of the main – iPhone SDK developers who created the SDK or something along those lines?
No. It's one of the guys in charge of the store.
Thank you. Right.
Yeah.
He wrote a fart app.
Well, before he got hired.
Right.
Before he got hired.
So I guess that one's in.
Yeah.
Now, wait a second. That's interesting, too, because he wrote one and then they hired him.
Well, his app was already approved.
I know. It's just funny. Yeah. He's like going through the interview and going, so what have you done with the iPhone?
Yeah, exactly.
I'll roll the fart app. You're in. Because you know what the other side looks
well,
like.
Well, you know, if you know Objective-C, you know it. It doesn't really matter what.
Oh, well, that's funny stuff. All right. Well, that's the end of our news. Long, rambling, and fun than it was. I want to plug one more thing Chariot's doing. Coming up on October 5th through 8th, if you're a Spring developer, we're running a Core Spring course, one of the Spring Source VMware courses. There are seats available. You go to www.chariotsolutions.com/education, and you'll see it in there in the mix of the classes. For this week, I'm Ken Rimple.
I'm Eric Schneider.
Make it a good week.